final panelist is somebody that I came to admire during the Reagan administration, somebody who fought this, which pipes to inside the system for a time, the good fight. Charles Fairbanks Jr., who is currently research professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington. He also directs the Foreign Policy Institute's program in Soviet and American national security policy making. Graduate of Yale and Cornell, received his doctorate from the University of Chicago, taught political science at the University of Toronto, then at Yale, and from 1981 to 84, he was at the State Department, where he was a member of the policy planning staff as a deputy assistant secretary. And he's currently finishing a book on the Soviet bureaucracy. Is that right? You better hurry, because there may not be a lot left.
East Asia. Although that does not mean that our side is winning. It's like other revolutions where the old order disintegrates, leaving confusion in its wake rather than a new order. And I will not argue that point because I want to discuss what I think is the more interesting issue which we should now be confronting, which is what we can learn from the collapse of communism. Our American and broader Western culture is marked by a faith in general ideas or universal principles, which is new in history. And you see that again and again, that when we have a foreign policy, we somehow want to call it a new world order. We have this love of principles. Now, in a way, all human societies have that. We did. We always had it. But those principles came from the Bible, from tradition. A couple of hundred years ago, there arose the idea that our general principles ought to come from evidence. They ought to come from the empirical world, from what actually happens. And in the light of that belief, which is diffused all through our society, it's a very striking fact that we do not evaluate the evidence we have about the empirical world. For example, the collapse of communism. Communism was the greatest social experiment in human history, an experiment in bringing reason down to earth, in making political, social, and cultural life conform to the dictates of reason. And that social experiment has failed. And not only did it fail, it destroyed the laboratory in which it took place. But we're not making any very great effort to learn from the failure of that experiment. Because, after all, the collapse of communism was something that was unexpected. Almost none of us expected that. And that's most obviously true of establishment Sovietology, which I suppose I stand here as a representative of in some sense, because it certainly argued in the course of the 1960s and 70s that the Soviet Union was not an exceptional society. It was a normal society, which was characterized by things like political participation, institutional pluralism, to use some concepts that became popular in Sovietology. Now, I never believed that. Nevertheless, I did not anticipate the collapse of communism. At the beginning of the Reagan administration, I thought that there was perhaps a chance, if we struggled very hard against our own bureaucracy within the United States, perhaps there was a chance to destroy communism in Poland. And that, in turn, might, over a longer period of time, doom it within the Soviet Union. That was much too pessimistic a vision, because the whole thing crumbled into dust within a decade after that. And that crumbling has provoked little explicit rethinking of our assumptions, except in the area of the market and of socialism. I do think that the idea of socialism is fatally and irretrievably marred at this point. The notion that a market of some kind is the correct economic solution is much stronger. And that's an important thing that we've learned, though it's a striking fact that people were already beginning to think that way before 1980, that our belief in the market and our disbelief in socialism is the confirmation of an intellectual trend that was already in progress, rather than something that we have concluded anew. That's not enough, I think. If you're libertarians, you might think, well, that is enough. You know, we've learned socialism is bunk, that the market is the answer. I don't think so, because that discussion remains within the limits of a kind of liberal orthodoxy, because we don't discuss why socialism failed or why the market works. There is virtually no discussion in the general public debate of property rights or of human nature and of what it might be in human nature that caused socialism to fail. And instead, you hear all the time, well, it failed. Socialism is a failure. It's great that we recognize that. But I think that is, in fact, a way of stopping the debate. It's, you know, as though doctors, when they're scrubbing up after the operation, say, well, how did the operation go? And the answer is, well, the patient died. And that kind of ends discussion about exactly what was wrong with the operation. But this is precisely what we need to know. What was wrong with communism? It strikes me that people are silently abandoning their old opinions, like the belief in socialism, and silently accepting new opinions, like the belief in the market, without ever really saying, I was wrong, and this is why I was. So this is what we ought to be examining. I believe that the collapse of communism and what we should learn from it ought to be the central topic of intellectual life in our times and the central topic of public debate. It's not only a question of Sovietology, a question about the Soviet regime, but also a question about the nature of the international system, about human nature, about the character of historical change, about the most fundamental issues. And it doesn't exclude what we can learn about ourselves from our reaction to the collapse of communism, which has not been a very enthusiastic one as a society. It's a very strange fact. Or what we can learn about ourselves from the attraction that so many of us had to socialism for more than a century. Conservatives ought to be leading this investigation. But I think as a group, we have not succeeded in leading it, and indeed we haven't tried tremendously hard. And I think there are three kinds of reasons for that failure. First, many conservatives are still arguing that communism is dangerous, which is a salutary and prudent response on the level of the military balance. science, but it creates the rhetorical problem that if we don't admit that communism is collapsing, we can't take credit for it. We cannot become the interpreters of why communism collapsed. If we say, well, it hasn't really happened, it's still just as dangerous as it ever was. Second, I think many of us understandably want to refocus discussion on the burning domestic issues. But I think the same assumptions underlie communism in the Soviet Union and the domestic left, ultimately. The problem of the intellectuals and the adversary culture. The strange contradictory beliefs that on the one hand there is nothing higher than man, but on the other hand that the specific empirical people and their motives and prejudices can be disregarded in social experimentation. Things of that character. There's a tremendous amount in common and a tremendous amount that we can bring to the domestic debate by understanding what was wrong with Soviet communism. Third, I think conservatives, unlike other people in the West, have understood that there is a possibility of noble failure. And we sometimes have thought of ourselves as people who have devoted themselves to something that failed, but nobly. I think that's short-sighted. We now have an opportunity to win once communism has collapsed. And we should all be asking ourselves right now, do we want to win? Now, I'll end just by raising the questions that I think ought to be involved in this debate. Beginning with the greatest surprise, which is the short lifespan of communism. The greatest academic statement of the nature of the communist system, the book Totalitarian Dictatorship and Autocracy by Friedrich and Brzezinski from 1956, predicts that communism would last for centuries. Instead, it lasted for 73 years, which is astonishing. One might have thought it would decay like other great imperial systems, but the Ottoman Empire lasted for 625 years. The Roman Empire lasted for 1,439 years. Communism lasted for 73 years in the Soviet Union, the twinkling of an eye in history. Why was that? And why were we wrong about that? Why did we think it was so strong and so enduring that it would endure even for centuries? Well, I think that we, with all of Western culture, assumed the malleability of man, that somehow human beings and society would be recast or remolded, to use Soviet language, and that even if that recasting wasn't ultimately satisfactory, it would take a tremendously long time to slough it off. In other words, we believe that culture dominates over nature, a belief that has something to do with relativism. And that turned out not to be true. The Soviets were unable to get their ideology believed throughout a whole society over a period of decades. Or you could say nature reasserted itself over the public discourse, over the culture. And that's, I think, the first thing that one ought to, first question one really needs to raise, is the question, does the collapse of communism show anything about human nature? Because it may show not only something about what human nature is, but also that there is such a thing as human nature, that there is not only culture, which after all was the belief that underlay the Declaration of Independence and the American founding. That certainly shows something about what human nature is. The fact that the market is so much more successful than socialism shows the belief to be correct, that people attain public goods most efficiently by seeking personal happiness. belief that very much underlay the American founding. And the weakness of the planned economy, I think, shows the weakness of reason. It also shows how great the taste for freedom is. I think we've already become used to the fact that the most legitimate political alternative in the Soviet Union is now democracy. And we forget how astonishing that is. You have here a country that was isolated from the rest of the world for 70 years and subjected to fantastic indoctrination. And when freed of that, people look to democracy and to natural rights as a kind of simple expression of what they want. That's a remarkable fact. Of course, the Soviet system did not only fall, it also rose. And so I think we need to ask ourselves what this says about the attraction of the utopian impulse. It seems to attract, but not to satisfy. And the two final questions, I'll raise them only as questions, we should ask, what does it show about the Enlightenment project of a political economy, a political community founded on science or truth or reason? And how does it make us judge an alternative kind of community, a community whose worldview is taken not from the truth or science, but from tradition or religion? I leave you with these questions. Thank you.